Back when they turned on electric at our house, the light bill was $1.50. And every month they'd turn it off and take us 2 months to get that $1.50 to get it turned back on.
It started with my grandmother, Leah, who was then a very young child, who had to flee from our native country, Namibia.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Laura Wexler.
And I am Jessica Henkin. And this week on the podcast, A Home Far Away, two tales of epic journeys in search of work, education, and safety. This first story was told at a recent show that Laura mentioned at on our last podcast episode that was in collaboration with the Baltimore Museum of Art. And this first storyteller, Mr. Carl Harding, was such a pleasure to get to know through this process. He is a Lumbee Indian by way of North Carolina, who now lives in the suburbs of Maryland and is an absolute character and just such, he's got just nothing but joy. I mean, he's just a joyful, joyful man. And so take a listen to his story of migration.
Hello, everyone. I was born a Native American in North Carolina from the Lumbee tribe. And my father was a sharecropper. We moved around every 2 years, and I went to every school in Robeson County. Dropped out of school at eighth grade because my father had cancer, and my brother and I had to take over about a 300-acre farm with two mules. And we never made a penny. We farmed all our life up till I was 15 years old, and my father would say, next year we'll get out of debt. Next year we get out of debt. I said, darn, there got to be a better way. So some guys came home from the weekend that had been working out of the area, and they was working in Morehead City as migrants, working farmland, farming. And they said, hey, why don't you go with us back to Morehead City? They said, the guy told us to bring him some help back on the farm. I was 15 years old. I went in there, packed all the clothes I had, which was a pair of underwear, a T-shirt, and another pair of pants and what I had on, and I threw it out the window in one of those shopping bags with the handles on it. Tuck off to Morehead City, went to work, worked 40 hours that week, and the guy gave me $40. And I felt guilty taking the money. I said, what in the hell is I going to do with all this money, man? It was a stack of money like that. I think it was all $1 bills. I had never seen that much money in my life. Back when they turned on electric at our house, the light bill was $1.50. And every month they'd turn it off and take us 2 months to get that $1.50 to get it turned back on. So when I saw all that money, I took that money home and went to bed that night and put it up under my back and opened my pocket knife and laid awake all night, afraid somebody was going to come in there and cut my throat and take my money. Well, after the first couple of weeks of that, I was hanging with them boys and started partying and figured out that wasn't quite enough money. I was going through that money faster than I could make it. But I did look out for my mom. When I go home on the weekends, I'd always give her some money. So when the work was over with, the farm work, I called my father and said, hey, I'll be coming home for the winter. He said, no, you won't. He says, we've got the farm done without you. And says, I think you better stay where you are. Well, if you made it this summer, you should be able to make it this winter. I'm thinking, damn, I'm 15 years old. What am I going to do now, Some of them boys said, hey, they're building a building down the road. Why don't you go there and get a job? They said, you had to be 16, though. I said, I'll tell the guy I'm 16. I walked in there and asked the guy, I said, hey, man, I'm looking for a job. He said, how old are you? I said, just turned 16. He said, well, what can you do? I said, I'd do anything. He said, what have you been doing? I said, farming all my life and doing anything anybody showed me how to do, I learned real fast. He said, all right. Back then, there was no subcontractors. One company had their own, every crew. They had all electricians, plumbers, everything. Every day, I'd go out with a different crew. So one day with the plumbers, one with electricians, carpenters, and all. So I learned to do a little bit of everything. And the guy said to me one day, young blood, said, you need a trade. I said, what are you talking about? He said, you need to learn one of these trades. He said, which one of these jobs that you work on do you like the best? I said, man, I like to see them bricklayers lay them brick. I said, that's amazing how they do that. He said, all right, you're going to be a bricklayer. I said, no, I don't want to be a bricklayer. Them guys told me that takes 3 years. I said, ain't you got something else I could do learn real quick? He said, well, what are you going to be doing for the next 60 years of your life? I started thinking about it. You know, he's right. He said, come in Monday morning. If you don't have any tools, turn around and go back home. Told me what kind of tools to buy. Went to work that Monday morning and put me with a bricklayer that built the corners. And I worked with him, and the first day I laid 25 brick, they took 24 up. Next day I laid 60 brick, they took out 10. Next day I laid 200 brick, and he brushed them down and touched them up a little bit and said, you're okay. 7 months, I had a crew. They gave me a five-man crew, and I learned a trade. Moved back to North Carolina and started working, making good money, helping my mother. And then I got wild, started partying a little bit, and figured I better settle down. So I got married. Saw I wasn't going to make it there around the same friends. When you're out there, you got to get away from the people that's hanging on to you and clinging. And every day I come home, they were saying, hey, come on out, let's go, let's go. And yeah, I just got married. I'm trying to settle down. So I called my sister, and she was living here in Maryland, and I asked her, I said, is there any jobs up there for bricklayers? She said, God, there's five ads in the paper. I said, can I come up and go to work and stay with you for a couple of days? She said, yeah, come on up. So I paid my bootleg bill that week, other little odds and ends, and I told my wife, I said, I'm going to get a bus ticket on a Greyhound, and I'm going to Baltimore, and then I'll come back and get you. She said, no, you won't. You get around in white, girls, I'll never see you again. So she packed up too, boy. We bought that two boat Greyhound tickets. I had $12 left. So I said, God, well, at least I'm going to be living with my sister. She'll have some food in the house. So we come into Baltimore, jumped on a cab, and he flew us down through the city, scared the living hell out of us. I thought I was going to go to jail just for riding too fast. And I showed the guy this address on his matchbox cover. And I said, do you know where this is? He said, yeah, jump. Yeah, let's go. He gets me in front of 27 North Broadway, and all the way there, every house looked identical. I said, how in the hell is he going to find this house and everything's identical? There you are right there, buddy. I said, what do you mean? He said, that house right there, that's 27 North Broadway. Look, man, I ain't getting out of this car unless you make sure my sister's living in that house. He said, what floor is she on? I told him, third floor. He goes over there and rings the doorbell. Window opens. Somebody pops their head out, and it was my sister. She had hair rollers as big as toilet tissue rings in her head. She looked out there, and she said, can I help you? I said, looked up. I said, oh, my God, that's my sister. That was the most beautiful face I had ever saw in my life. I was scared to death in that big city, boy. She said, he said, yeah, somebody in the car will say that they're related to you. I said, don't worry about it. I got it from here, boy. And he threw them suitcases out, and I gave him about $3 or $4 of that $12. Went up, and Monday morning I had a job. Went to work in Crofton. They had just started building Crofton then. I worked there 10 years. When we finished up Crofton, we started branching out doing subdivisions, and one of the builders says, young blood, why don't you start your own business? I said, man, I don't know nothing about having no business. I ain't got but 8th grade education. He said, I'll help you. I became a contractor, built homes, and raised a family, built my own home. I built about 15 homes during that time. And still a contractor at 78 years old, mingling around, but I got a small crew and I love what I'm doing. And America is the place to be. But funny thing, when I went first day I went to the job, the guy said, there's another one of them hillbillies from North Carolina. I wonder how he called me a hillbilly. I ain't never seen a hill in my life. All that. North Carolina, on them field farms, you could see look like 10 miles and nothing, no hills or anything. So funny day, I went to Ellicott City to work, and I went home and wrote my mother a letter that night and said, guess what, Mama? "We worked in the mountains today," she said. "I had never seen a mountain in my life." I said, "We worked in the mountains. I thought Ellicott City was mountains." "I'm a hillbilly. I don't see any hill." Thank you. Enjoyed it.
So what's wonderful about Carl is that the things that are charming about him as an older man were probably a bit dangerous and dastardly when he was young.
Yeah.
I love how he talks about how he had to pay off his bootlegging his bootlegging bill. And I was talking with him afterwards about moonshine and running from the revenue agents and all of that. So he is a man of 1,000 stories and part of the large population of Lumbee Indians who came to Baltimore in the years after, during and after World War II to work in factories here. So, and there's great work being done to really share the history of those folks here in Baltimore. We'll be right back with another story. So this second story that we have for you today is shared by Dr. Obed Norman. And he is quite a man, and his story is both personal and also political and social. And again, this story was shared at a show that we did in partnership with Baltimore Museum of Art. It was a show about migration stories, and it was in honor of an exhibit featuring new work on the Great Migration. And it runs at Baltimore Museum of Art through January 29th. If you can, check it out. The BMA is free and wonderful, and we were so delighted to partner with them on this. Take a listen.
Well, my migration story has two parts. There's a political part, which involves involuntary migration, forced migration. And the second part is more a personal migration, which was unforced and which was very satisfying. But let's start with the political story of migration. It started with my grandmother, Leah. My grandmother, Leah, who was then a very young child, who had to flee from our native country, Namibia, and they had to flee to the neighboring country of Botswana. And the reason why they had to flee to the neighboring country of Botswana was because the German government had decreed a genocide against my ethnic group, which is the Ovaherero in Namibia. That was the first genocide of the 20th century. It took place in the years 1904 to 1908. And in that genocide, 85% of my people, the Ovaherero people of Namibia, were murdered by the German forces. And the reason why the German forces did the genocide was because when Germany first came over to Namibia to colonize the country, what happened is that my people, the Ovaherero people, resisted that colonization. The Germans wanted to take over our country, and our people resisted that colonization. And in the early battles of that colonization and in the early battles of the resistance against the Germans, the Hereros, the Ovahereros, and the Namas, who were their allies, they soundly beat the Germans. And because of that, the Germans then sent more troops to Namibia, more weapons, and then they put out the genocide, which is to kill every man, woman, and child of those two groups, the Namas and the Hereros. And 85% of our people died. So my grandmother then was in Botswana, where she grew up. Now starts the second part of my migration story, which is the personal part. It starts with my grandfather, David, who was then a young man, about 1920, was about the year that he migrated from Malawi through Zambia and then went to Botswana, where he met, you guessed it, my grandmother. And the two of them then married, they were two young people, married, and out of that marriage came my mother, whose name was Teresa. So I have my own mother, Teresa. So my grandfather then, my mother was born in 1925, and 20 years later, I was born in 1945. And I grew up in Botswana. I was a child of exile, born in the shadow of this great genocide, which we mourn to this day. What happened then is that in my early years, I then went back to my country, Namibia, where I did my early education. And after that, I moved to South Africa, where I got my high school education and my undergraduate degrees. And I worked in South Africa for 20 years as a STEM teacher. Then came opportunities. I got a Fulbright Fellowship from the United States government. So I came to the United States. I did my master's degree at Penn State, and I then went on to the University of Iowa, where I did my doctorate. And then I spent the next 30 years here in this country being a university professor. Now I'm graduated from Morgan State. And I have two missions that I continue in my life. And both those two missions are actually informed by my two immigration stories. The first mission that I have, and this came from the political part of the migration story, is that I am very much a part of the struggle for reparations against that genocide that the Germans instituted against my people. The other part of my mission is a mission of gratitude. Gratitude to the Botswana government, who through their kindness and the generosity gave a place for my grandparents and eventually my parents to have a place in Botswana. In fact, although the wars are now over, my people are still living, actually, my immediate family, many of them are still living in the country of Botswana. So I feel a sense of gratitude to that country, and I also feel a sense of gratitude towards the United States, which gave me the opportunity to come here, get my education up to the level of a doctorate, and then gave me a work throughout my life to work here. And now I'm retired. And during the last years of my work as a researcher, I have developed an intervention through my work, my research work, which is funded by the National Science Foundation. And that work was to find out a way that we can help especially black students do better in their STEM, the science studies. And I've developed over 20 years of research, developed this intervention, and I've now started a nonprofit. And the purpose of this nonprofit is to spread that intervention all over the world. Because using that intervention, I have obtain a great degree of success with my students at the HBCU in the STEM field. So that is the story of my immigration, and thank you very much.
I was talking with Dr. Norman afterward because I was really struck by that line in his story saying that the German genocide of his ethnic group was the first genocide of the 20th century. Yeah. And, you know, it's just that feeling of, wow, 85% of his ethnic group was decimated, and I, who is a 50-year-old person, have never heard about this.
Yeah.
And feeling both grateful and also really pissed that this history hasn't been part of, you know, anything that anyone ever talked to me about. So it was just a profound experience to listen to his story. And I remember another thing he said, I don't think this was in his story, but that he felt a lot of responsibility as someone who had a chance to come here and get educated to make sure that, you know, he wasn't part of a brain drain, but rather a brain gain, and really trying to return his learnings and his expertise and talent to Africa, where he's from.
Thank you so much for listening to our stories this week, and we look forward to bringing you more soon.
We want to thank Maureen Harvey for producing the podcast, and we want to ask you to visit us at stoopstorytelling.com to learn about live events and listen to other episodes. You can find us on social media at Stoop Storytelling. See you soon.